It's 9:06, and welcome to another edition of the Sundance Reel. I'm KPCW News Director. And for the next 8 days, KPCW will be introducing you to some of those who have film screening at this year's festival. I'm joined today by my co-host, Park City Attorney, and KPCW Friday film reviewer, Mark Harrington. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie.
So try as we may, we haven't been able to secure a lot of screenings for the four films that we've been talking about today. And one, of course, not a film, but more of just a series. But what's on your list of I don't want to miss?
Well, I did get to see one of the opening films last night. So Our New President and I'm going to butcher this name, so I apologize, but Maxim Pozdorovakin, who, of course, gave us Pussy Riot, a Punk's Prayer, previously. And he returned with this film that he wrote and directed about Russian media and propaganda regarding the Trump and Clinton election. And, you know, very, very interesting idea. He wanted to use primarily just real-time footage from news agencies in Russia to show the perspective of not only was there election interference, but that the propaganda machine from the state-run news studio was, you know, alive and well and running not only internally to Russia, but worldwide. And from that perspective, the film was a success. I think it did demonstrate that, and the footage was very compelling. Its delivery was, you know, he likes that the sort of real-time style, and it with a little bit of a use of a film, what I'd say a film student metaphor at the beginning, that and end that had a blend of this weird use of music and sound and this other, as I said, this metaphor that just didn't really bookend it for me. And so I thought it was a little stressing to watch 90 minutes of that footage. If you remember, like Hunger Games, where you see the fictional portrayal of the news agency, like picture yourself watching 90 minutes of that. And then as interesting as it is, because it's real, it's a little strained for the audience to sit through.
Yeah. So what else is on your list of to see?
Well, I always focus a lot on the documentaries. I, of course, want to see some of the legal ones of personal interest in terms of the issues that are pressing today in terms of the Me Too movement and Supreme Court with RBG and Seeing All Red. I do encourage people to not forget about the Jane Fonda documentary because, you know, her presence, much like Meryl Streep's, has been this, you know, beginning and end run that, not end, but continuation, I should say, of a much more complex role that I think is a lot more dynamic and interesting to me. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the docs always capture my attention as well. And one that looked pretty interesting was this Louis, how do you say it? Cihuos, the Cove director, mm-hmm. Louis Cihuos. Yes. The Game Changers, it's about a story of an elite special forces trainer. And as he travels the world on a quest for the truth behind the world's most dangerous myth that meat is necessary for protein strength and optimal health. So it's kind of...
Yeah, and he's bringing a huge force of support to town with him, and I think that's gotten a lot of buzz because it is just fascinating backstory, and I was pleased to see that as a press and industry screening tomorrow night, so hopefully can get into that as well.
Yeah, and of course RBG sounds really interesting as well. So with all that's going on with Treasure Hill as part of your real job and all that's involved in the city hosting Sundance, I mean, how much time do you really have to watch any films?
Well, you really got to pick your time windows smartly, particularly with the family as well. So, you know, I do a lot of late screenings and not as much midday in the prime time that I used to do. But, you know, I think the festival does do a tremendous job taking care of press, and having a role here with the studio does afford me that press and industry screening where you get those alt times and the different availability, and that really saves me. And so I'm very thankful for that, and kind of, of course, allows me to keep the pulse for the studio as well.
Okay, we're going to get on with it. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. We're going to bring in our first guest.
Support for the Sundance Reel on KPCW comes from the film Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, premiering during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, a documentary about Sandra Lee's journey through breast cancer from diagnosis to recovery and encouraging early detection for all women.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Well, we're kicking off our Sundance Reel with a film that poses a moral dilemma. What would you do if you saw a police officer who clearly committed a crime that you captured on your cell phone, if it meant exposing yourself to the fallout that would inevitably accompany such a decision? Well, joining us in the studio is Ronaldo Marcus Green. He's the director of the film Monsters and Men, and he's going to explain how he answered that question. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the film is in the U.S. Dramatic Competition. Why don't you just begin by telling us a little bit more about it?
The film is set in Bed-Stuy. It's a triptych. So we follow a gentleman as he videotapes an incident of police brutality, and then how that videotape sort of affects the community, the ripple effects of that. So we follow a police officer who's working in the same precinct that apprehends this particular gentleman. That's the second chapter, and sort of how he has to deal with the growing community outrage about this situation. But he's also a police officer who is, it's his job to serve and protect. So he has to go to work every day and do his job, but the community is sort of backlashing against him during that time. And then the third chapter is about a young African-American aspiring athlete who is, has nothing to do with that, but lives in the neighborhood and is sort of, affected by these situations by proxy. He's there and he can't sort of, without giving too much away, he can't turn a blind eye to the things that are happening in his community, and he has a choice to make about what to do about it.
Well, that may have been the 2-minute trailer that I saw as he was leaving out to go out at night. His father pulls him aside. I think it was his father, yeah. Basically saying, "You've got a big day tomorrow." So he must have been the athlete.
He is the athlete in the film. So yeah. Calvin Harrison Jr.
All right. So you've taken an interesting perspective. I mean, again, showing the instances through the eyes of the bystander. So any real life instance that triggered this idea for you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I grew up in Staten Island. The most notable case is obviously the Eric Garner case in Staten Island that happened. But there's been a number of instances around the country. Walter Scott, Fernando Castillo. I mean, the list goes on. But growing up in Staten Island, that one really hit home. That was like, I used to deliver pizza in that neighborhood. That was like, I knew that neighborhood back and forth. And so when that happened, it was like, this is in my backyard. I also grew up in a family where my father, had a gun and a shield. He worked for the Department of Investigation. But he didn't, wear a uniform. So he was just a black man, in Staten Island. And that's a very interesting place to grow up. If you don't know Staten Island very much, it's a racially charged place to kind of grow up. But he had this gun and shield, so he had this certain level of protection, So I grew up with a lot of admiration for, law enforcement, and my friends are cops. Staten Island's all cops, construction workers, very blue collar, playing football, high school football with these people, and they're my friends, So I have a lot of respect for cops. I have a lot of friends that are cops. They're in the movie. A couple of New York City police officers are actually actors in the film. I have some disdain for some of the institutional, practices. So that's sort of where I kind of pull from my personal life and experience.
And do you think that those perspectives are not being heard in the current dialogue? Is that what motivated, bringing this film?
Yeah, I mean,
forward?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been films, and I'm glad that these films are out there. And listen, Spike Lee has been talking about it for 20 years. So it's not the first time that we've tackled these situations. This, I thought, was a way to re-engage in the dialogue. We hadn't seen a black police officer on screen in a movie in a long time. I couldn't remember one since like Ricochet, where I had seen one that wasn't like in a television, television show. And so I said, okay, that's a really interesting perspective. We hadn't seen the guy who videotaped these these situations. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting way to get into the story without, you know, and see the people whose lives are affected by them rather than focusing on, you know, the victim. So that was sort of the angle of, you know, this is an interesting way to reengage in the dialogue in a way that we haven't seen it.
Well, your reference police officer makes me think way back to, of course, James Baldwin's written a lot about perspective and race, but most people forget about his America Cinema essays as well. Mm. And in, I think it's the Devil Finds Work, he was extremely critical of early cinema about even a black police officer, Sidney Poitier's role in The Heat of the Night. And Billy, in the movie on Billie Holiday, as I recall, as well, which I think I wrote down the quote. He called it, "is as empty as a banana peel and as treacherous." And so was there a concern that in taking this on that you face the challenge of not being the, you know, the liberal sort of Hollywood self-congratulating take on it versus, no, I want to bring authenticity to this conversation and make a difference?
You know, to be honest, I had a short film at Sundance in 2015 called Stop. It was about a young African-American man walking home from practice, and he gets stopped and frisked by the police. And in that film is my New York City friend and cop. You know, he's a cop. And we were celebrating the film here at Sundance, you know, just 2 o'clock in the morning having pizza. And we started talking about the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, just as two friends who grew up in that area. And one thing led to another. We just got into a really heated debate about this particular tape. And I was like, okay, he's in my movie. He's liberal. He's progressive. But something's happening here. I see a guy that should be alive when I look at that video. And he sees a guy that it was unfortunate that he was dead, but he was resisting arrest. And so when I heard that, I just was like, well, just because he was resisting, you know, and it was really like, this conversation, I'd never had a conversation in my adult life that felt like where I had arms, you know, my hair and my arms were standing up. And, you know, by the end of the conversation, my friend was basically in tears. And he was talking about, like, you don't understand what it's like being a police officer. You don't understand, you know, what we face every day. And you don't understand, you know, what it's like getting a domestic violence call. Like, everything that wasn't really on the tape. And I kept trying to go back to the tape. But Brian, like, you know, he should still be alive. And so that it was really that conversation that we had based on the short that I had made that made me open up my eyes to this. And, you know, listen, he was saying things that I, you know, even though I didn't agree, was like, okay, he has a perspective here that's worth hearing. And if I shut him down or I don't pay attention, that maybe there's no path forward. I think we were really both trying to understand each other. And, you know, after that, we hugged it out and, you know, we just said, okay, that's fine. And you know, that conversation sat with me for 6 months. And then I started to develop the script based on that conversation that I had with my buddy, who's a cop. And I told him about it. And he was like, I'm so happy that you did that. And he's back in the feature film and we're friends. And, you know, that's what the film was really about, finding that perspective. And people need to hear it. You know, I didn't want to hear it, but, like, it's out there. A lot of people feel that way. He's one of the good ones. So that's really where the conversation started about, you know, to make the feature.
Well, I don't know if you heard David Curry or one of the programmers earlier just saying, if it has the word monsters in it, it's great.
Oh, okay.
So tell us a little bit about that monster. I mean, I guess you'll tell us who the monsters are. We'll see.
Well, you know, I think it's more of a, you know, it's obviously about the duality of men and women. You know, it's, you know, the women characters in the film are super strong and super powerful. And you know, I think it's really about having that choice. You know, you can choose to turn a blind eye or you can do something about it. And I think each protagonist in the film is sort of faced with that question. You know, what do you do? And I think that's really where the film sits and lies. It doesn't try to, you know, answer the questions. It just tries to propose them and let you come to the conclusion. And hopefully you feel complicit with these characters to make that decision. I look at that video and I'm like, yeah, I know what I would do if I was in that situation. I wouldn't kill him. But he's saying, you don't know what you would do if there's a big guy and he's coming at you. And so you're sort of forced to make that decision as, you know, as you're in the theater. And I think I wanted the film to feel that way. I wanted to feel present. I wanted to feel like the conversation I had with my friend that kind of blindsided me. I wasn't expecting that. And I wanted the film to kind of have you on the edge of your seat that way and feel like, okay, you know, I understand. I can look at this situation differently in a way that doesn't close the conversation but kind of opens it up.
And as you were involved in casting the film, what features did you look for to have a cast that could reflect that duality and that importance of not necessarily good and bad?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, like anytime you're making a movie, you know, there, you always go through the how are you going to cast this thing in order to get the financing for the movie. So, you know, we went through that. Oh, we're going to have to get a star in order to do that, and you get the usual suspects. But, you know, it's a very authentic film in that way, and I didn't want it to be overshadowed. I don't want the importance of the film in my, you know, or what I was trying to say to be overshadowed by like a superstar. So, you know, I let the producers know that. I think they respected that. I don't think this is the kind of movie you produce unless you really care about these kind of things. And I think they really respected the fact that I wanted to try to find up and coming talent. And, you know, we were able to get some names and some up-and-comers in the film that I'm super excited for everybody to see. And you know, Anthony Ramos and Jasmine Cephas Jones and Kelvin Harrison Jr. I mean, folks that have been around and stuff, but you really don't know. John David Washington, who you had seen on a television show, but not a lot of people have seen him in movies. And I think they really deliver. You know, they're hungry, they're young. You know, I'm just excited for them to get in front of, you know, for the audience to see fresh faces on screen. And I think when you don't know people, you can kind of fall into something. Not say, oh, that's the person from the thing. It's like you kind of fall into the role in a way that I think really allows you to just experience the film rather than saying, oh, that's my favorite person from that show or that kind of thing. So,
well, people will get the premiere, yeah. 12:15 at the main stage there on the Eccles today. And again, Sunday. Night at the Redstone. We also have a screening Wednesday at noon at the Park City Library, and then Friday the 26th here at the Egyptian. Good luck, and thanks for spending
some
time
with
us.
Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it. Okay.
That's the director of the film Monsters and Men, part of the U.S. Dramatic Competition, Ronaldo Marcus Green. This is the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, ESCO. Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub. We drink our share and sell the rest. WasatchBeers.com.
It's 9:24. Good morning. Well, Academy Award winner for 20 Feet from Stardom, Morgan Neville, once again avoids making a traditional biodoc and instead takes us behind the curtain to see how Mr. Rogers navigated the cultural and social issues of the second half of the 20th century with his own brand of forward-thinking, compassionate wisdom far beyond his time. Morgan Neville joins me in the studio along with a couple of his producers, Nicholas Ma and Karen Capitesto. Good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Everyone loves this movie, and we haven't even seen it yet. You're not going to show us a Mr. Rogers we don't know, right?
It's not. So who Fred really was, and I call him Fred, it's not dissonant with your idea of him. There's not a big dark secret, but who he really was a much more profound, deeper version of who you see on television. You know, he was somebody with an iron will, with incredible intelligence, with incredible direction with what he wanted to do with his show. And that, to me, was kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Why Mr. Rogers and why now?
Yeah, well,
he's going to be gone,
50 years.
15,
so
yeah.
This year, 2018, is the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood becoming a national television show. So the whole idea started years ago when I was starting a documentary called The Music of Strangers with Yo-Yo Ma. And one day at lunch, I happened to ask Yo-Yo, how do you figure out how to be a famous person? And he said, oh, Mr. Rogers taught me. And I kind of laughed. And he just said, no, I'm not kidding. I went on his show and we became friends. And he really recognized that I was going through something. And he mentored me throughout my life as to how to use my notoriety as a force for positive change. And that just kind of blew my mind. And it was the first of many breadcrumbs that led me to think that there might be a documentary about Fred. And as I was thinking about it, I called up Nicholas Ma, Yo-Yo's son, who I become friends with and who's a filmmaker. And I said, is this a crazy idea or not, Nicholas?
I mean, it's a wonderful idea. I mean, Fred was a hero of mine. I'd been on the show when I was 6 and then again when I was 16. And, you know, I played with my father on both of those episodes, which is something I've never done in any other context. So Fred had a particular magic in my life. And the fact that that magic was true in Morgan's life and true in my father's life, I think certainly made it clear to me that there was something special to explore.
Yeah, his message was, I think, something we need now more than ever, and just the uplifting he does for children and just some mental health here.
Well, yeah. I'd go one step further. If the old adage is everything I needed to learn, I learned in kindergarten, is everything I needed to survive a Trump presidency, I learned from Mr. Rogers. Is that the next tagline?
I think I could use that. I mean, when you really distill Fred's message down to a bumper sticker, what we came up with is radical kindness, this idea of ultimate empathy and understanding. And that is something that it's just so great to hear. And the thing about Fred was that he wasn't just there to comfort people. I mean, he didn't talk down to kids. He talked about war. He talked about all kinds of issues, death. You know, he's doing a kid show for 2 to 6 year olds and doing episodes about death and bullying and violence. And yeah, it's incredible what he was doing. But hearing how he helps you process these things, just for us making the film, it was like, this is the voice we want to hear. You know, hopefully it's a voice people want to hear out there in the world. But to me, in a way, it feels like the most current of any film I've ever made, even though it's rooted in the past. Yeah.
You know, I think I totally agree in this moment, Fred is more important than ever. But part of why is he believed that we could all come together around a basic idea that we should put children first. And I think that that's something that, regardless of where one falls on a political spectrum, should be at least the beginnings of a unifying call to action for all of us.
Well, I mean, many of us in public media have certainly seen his presentation to Congress, you know, back in 69, when back then we were even fighting against the budget cuts. And the story goes on. But, I mean, he had, you know, one of the congressmen literally in tears over his presentation.
Yeah. I mean, it's a kind of a legendary, famous performance. And this is the very beginning of public broadcasting. So, you know, Johnson signs the Public Broadcasting Act in 67. They start what becomes NPR and PBS in 68. And Nixon becomes president and wants to cut the funding. And they bring in Fred after days of Senate testimony to come in. And he melts these senators, including John Pastore, who's the head of the committee. And he makes such a compelling argument for the value of public broadcasting that, to me, that's another message, and one you probably appreciate here, that we feel needs to be heard again in this day and age. We need to make that same argument now more than ever. And it's just another example of what is so incredibly current about everything he's been saying all along.
Yeah. So when you think of the tenure of his time on TV, I mean, where did you even begin with trying to tell this story?
Well, kind of the amazing thing was when we started making the film, we went down and we met with Mrs. Rogers and, with the estate. And Fred kept everything, every show, every outtake. He wrote all of his music, every letter. He got something like 1 million letters throughout his career, and he responded to every letter he got. It's all in a giant archive there outside of Pittsburgh. And it was like it had been waiting for us when we decided to make the film. And as filmmakers, you know, it's just like being handed the keys to the kingdom. And so for us, it was just a matter of digesting this mountain of incredible material and just finding nugget after nugget. And it was, yeah.
Well, that's what I say. And then what? It's just like, oh, you'd have a 200-hour film.
Yes.
Well, I'm curious about the title, because the title is obviously his introduction song, and you have a long history of a proclivity for music, obviously. It does Johnny Costa get his day here? Do we get a little bit of what was the, because a lot of people don't know that jazz was such an important part of that, and that was its own big decision because he got a lot of heat for staying with Mr. Costa for so long, and I think what I've read is he was very, as you said, iron-willed that children can understand that if given the right format. And so does what part does music play in this film for you?
A little bit. You know, I mean, there was so much to talk about. Johnny Costa was his longtime piano player, who was one of the most incredible jazz pianists around. And Fred himself had been a composition major in college, wrote every song, something like 200 songs throughout his career. So he loved music, and he was a great piano player himself. So music was a huge part of it. You know, I think, you know, we touch on it, but, you know, I feel like we're scraping many surfaces at the same time. And yeah, that's just one of the many dimensions. When I was talking about the kind of the unseen dimensions of Fred Rogers, that's just one of many.
Well, with such a big story, then back to the, sort of the original question, if we now understand why now, how do you make this film? I mean, let me ask this a different way. I'm a 22-year-old, you know, double major from Colorado College in economics and screenwriting, and I'm a woman, and I'm coming here for the respect rally and all this other stuff, and I meet a great bartender, and she offers to give me two tickets to this film and says my mom was on the board of such and such, and we should go see this film because...
I mean... Hopefully, you know, we don't have to, you know, persuade people to come. But I feel like Fred, if you have any relationship with Fred, he occupies a part of your soul already. And what's so interesting about it is those of us who grew up with Fred Rogers, and there were many generations of people that did, and now even today with Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, the number one kid show on PBS, you know, another generation of kids growing up with that DNA in there, that... I can't think of another subject that speaks to our own inner child, if I can use that term, in such a profound way. And working on the film, and I think viewing the film, takes you back to your own 5-year-old self. Mm-hmm. And in a way, kind of unlocks a lot of things that are in your kind of almost pre-memory. It's very interesting, but I think it's oddly therapeutic and hopefully in a very kind of beautiful way. So today is our premiere, and I cannot wait to see what this does to an audience.
So I don't know you, but you are wearing a cardigan. I mean, do you always wear cardigans, or is that just your Mr. Rogers look?
I've been accused of being a little Mr. Rogers-y myself, but the cardigan I did especially today for the premiere, I had to break it out.
Awesome. Okay. Well, yeah, I think that's a nice touch. Yeah.
Thank you.
As you went through all of this stuff, and I'm guessing you talked to people who knew and worked with him over the time, is he the ever optimistic and kind person that we know and love him as?
Sure. I mean, he is, but he's not a Pollyanna, you know, and I think that's a crucial distinction. I mean, he was somebody that was, he's the epitome of the better angels of our nature, that he was always looking for the best, but never expected it to be such. And part of what was important to us, and this is even from our very first conversation with Mrs. Rogers, she said, Fred was not a saint, and don't make him one. And I think that's crucial, because if you make him a saint, then it says to an audience, well, he was different. We don't have to try. And what you see in the film is that he struggled from the beginning, the middle, and the end of his life with his mission. He was constantly questioning his own worth, if he had succeeded. And that is something that's completely identifiable, I think, for all of us.
Yeah. So the film is in competition. My understanding is that it has already been acquired. So does it go to theatrical release, or is it a PBS?
No, it's going to come out in theaters June 8th. So if you don't see it here at Sundance, please come see it in theaters. And it will eventually be on PBS because there's no way this film couldn't be.
Okay. Just one Saturday Night Live question. Did the Eddie Murphy skit make the cut? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the skit made the cut.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, again, the premiere of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is this afternoon, 2:30 at the PC Mark. It'll run again Saturday at noon at the Temple Theater, on Friday the 26th at 12:30 at the Ray. So those are the local ones. You also have a couple of Salt Lake screenings. Good luck. I mean, you've done it. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks.
We've been talking with, again, the director and producers of Won't You Be My Neighbor, Morgan Neville, along with Nicholas Ma and Karen Capostosto. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
Hey, have you been to the Swanner Eco Center? Do you know they have a climbing wall?
I love the Saturday morning snowshoe tours and learning about the wetlands. The exhibits are cool too.
Do you know you can go to the top of the observation tower to look for wildlife?
Connect to nature at Swanner Eco Center, located in the New Park Town Center.
Visit SwannerEcoCenter.org for more information. Thanks to all our supporters. Swanner is a nonprofit organization and a supporter of KPCW.
Well, with his seventh production at Sundance this year, director Steve James enters into Sundance's newest program, the Indie Episodic, with his 10-part series, America to Me, examining racial, economic, and class issues in contemporary American education. Steve James joins us now in the studio. Good morning and welcome.
Great to be here.
So I managed to see one of the episodes, but I'm going to have you give us the Reader's Digest version of America to Me. And I have to say, I love the fact that you used Langston Hughes's poem, Let America Be America Again, as your backdrop.
Yeah, well, so we, we start out following about seven kids, mostly black and biracial kids, and we followed them over the course of one school year, the 2015-2016 school year, at Oak Park River Forest High School, which is where my kids went. And I always thought that it would be interesting to look at race and education in a place like Oak Park, where it's a very liberal community, it's a very diverse community, it takes an enormous pride in its history around these issues, and it's a well-funded, very large public school, and yet there are these struggles, but there's also, great success going on there, but there are also very real struggles.
Yeah, so when you originally approached the school board for, what did you tell them you wanted to do?
I told them kind of what I just told you. I mean, I wanted to look at race and achievement in this community, in this school, because this is something that we have been wrestling with in this community for decades. And I think to the school board's credit, they were willing to kind of take a leap of faith with me to let me in, because the administration of the school, the principal and the superintendent, did not want this to happen.
Well, and that's what I noticed. And the principal and the vice principal, both black, and didn't want you there. And I guess I was surprised by that. It was really it's the crack that lets the light in, no?
Right. Well, the vice principal, Shayla Holland, was she you find out in episode two. a little spoiler. No, that she left the school right at the beginning of the school year to take another job. She was supportive. That's why she consented to the interview that she gave. And she pops up in different points in the film to make very, wise insights. But the principal is black. The superintendent of the school is Asian American. And I think, from their point of view, I understand why they were resistant, because this problem isn't all their fault. I mean, this is a problem in America. And the fact that it has persisted for decades in Oak Park is unfortunate. And it's unfortunate that more hasn't been done to turn it around. But it's not all at their feet. And I think they probably figured that they only have to lose in this, to look like they're not doing what they should be doing. But I really wish they had cooperated, because I think it would have allowed us to see into, you know, their heart around these issues and the efforts that they really truly are trying to make.
I think your press papers do reflect, though, that one of the teachers ended up becoming a producer or having a larger role. Was that all the more important to have that person reach out and actively participate because of that initial resistance?
Well, so John Conney, who is the producer and teacher you're talking about, John is the one that first, you know, I gave an interview with my last film, you know, Life Itself, in a local paper there. And the reporter asked me if I was had any projects that I was really wanted to do all these years. And I just mentioned this one in passing, never thinking it was possible. And John reached out to me and said, I think it is possible to do this. And he was the one that informed me about the school board. So having a teacher on the ground, though, during the filming, you know, that was part of the production was great. And John actually is in the film because some of our kids took his classes. And so as the series progresses, you see him as part of the story as well.
Yeah. So how did you pick those that you were going to, the seven kids that you were going to focus on? I mean, they didn't audition, or did they?
Well, we did go through a process of putting the word out, putting the word out to parents and trying to find kids and families that were interested in being a part of this. And so there was it wasn't an audition in that traditional sense, but there was a series of interviews. We probably interviewed about 40 kids before we began production. And we selected these seven to start. And then as we went along, because of the nature of the beast, we actually added kids. So but by the end of the production, we were following a dozen kids.
Right. And then when
that's how you get to 10 hours, you know.
And then when you get to somebody like Keyshawn.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, oh, my gosh. Right. I mean, then he just like becomes the star. Right.
Yes.
Just because of his big personality.
Yes.
And at the same time, you want to knock him over the head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Keyshawn is a really great kid and a great subject in this documentary. And, you know, if you see through the whole span of the series, he and his family go through a lot of ups and downs, you know, both in their personal lives as well as in his academic life. And then you have this teacher, Jess Stovall, who is his English teacher. And again, as you watch the series more, she emerges as a major subject in the film. And her sort of dedication to him and other students, but you see it very explicitly in his case, her dedication to sort of making him a good student and do well in her class is pretty extraordinary.
I grew up in a school district which was 99.9% white, and they also force a strata of students by categorizing classes by number, numerically, 8-0, 8-1 for eighth grade,
right.
8-0 down to 8-7. And the 8-7-1s were the less smart students,
yeah.
And the 8-0 were the smartest students. And the best teachers went with the smartest kids all through the entire district.
Right.
And so my brothers, who were usually classified in some of the lower classes, were doomed for failure from my perspective right out of the gate. Are there lessons learned from your experience that go beyond just race and are really, and I think you mentioned this in some of your materials as well, a definition of success and the standardization of school success? Is that a broader issue that transcends the race issue?
Yeah, I don't know if it transcends race, but it certainly is a larger issue. I mean, a school like Oak Park River Forest High School, which is, you know, very integrated, there is this very sort of rigid, almost tracking system within the school. There's the AP level students who are virtually all white. Then there's the honors level, which is overwhelmingly white. Then you get down to college prep, which is really regular track in most places, but in Oak Park we call it college prep, which is very, very integrated. And then as you get to special ed and transitions tracks, I mean, it gets blacker and blacker. And, you know, these are sort of baked in realities of our educational system that then go on to perpetuate the kinds of achievement disparities that go on. One of the things that we get into in the film is really questioning also the ways in which we measure education when it comes to things like, you know, ACT scores and GPAs, because that is one kind of very narrow and empirical way of measuring whether kids are really being educated or not and whether they're engaged in education. One of our kids, Jada, who's at the festival, going to be at the festival for the premiere, she's a kid that is incredibly passionate about education And yet she also has lower ACT scores than you would ever imagine when you see her and meet her. And so it speaks to some of the sort of systemic issues that go on around race and achievement.
So again, when you have a year and 12 kids, I mean, you know, you don't have a 2 hour or even like a 3 hour movie like Hoop Dreams. So at what point was it decided that, oh, this is going to be an episode?
Well, you know, people for years have been begging me to do a 10-hour film. I mean, everywhere I go, people say, would you please do a 10-hour film? No, that's not true. You know, the way it really happened was actually when I was when we were presenting to the school board and right before they were going to make a decision whether to vote on it. And one of the school board members said, how can you deal with all the things that you want to deal with in a single 2-hour film? And I made the joke, like, have you seen my films? They're rarely 2 hours. But I went on to say that I think you're right. I think this ideally wants to be a miniseries, and we will endeavor to try to do that. So the idea was from the start. The question then became, okay, how are we going to make that happen? And honestly, it never would have happened if Participant Media had not stepped in. Diane Weierman, she got this idea immediately, and they came on board along with funding from the MacArthur Foundation, and they were like, do it. Just go do the series.
And did you sense you had more or less freedom or same in terms of an episodic production versus the deliverable of a film?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I probably had too much freedom, which is why it's 10 hours long. But it really is like making one long film. I mean, we anchor each episode in a kind of set piece, like a football game at the end of episode one, a homecoming dance at the end of episode two. So we really are sort of following the school year and all of the kinds of rites of passage and things that go with that. But at the same time, we're delving more deeply into the lives of these kids and their education.
So the way that you've got this working is that when people buy a ticket, they get to see the first three? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so we are the best bargain at the Sundance Film Festival, I just want to say. Because if you buy a single ticket, you get to come to our premiere on Monday at 6 p.m. for the first 3 hours. And then, at no extra charge, you get to come back Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. and see episodes 4 and 5. I mean, what could be better? Seriously.
Yeah, for one ticket price.
One ticket price.
And then so the rest of the screenings?
Is there a hangover brunch in between? Or I mean, yeah. that would make it better to answer your question.
That's true. We didn't really think that through. And then there's other screenings in the festival. There's two other times it's playing, once in Salt Lake City and once again here in Park City. And for those, you're signing up for the 5-hour with an intermission marathon. But, you know, there's some hearty souls out there that want to do that and, you know, maybe can't get into some of the movies they want to go to, so they'll kill 5 hours with us.
Well, yeah, and I think it's awesome that that Sundance kind of included this. We saw after the popularity of O.J. and the People,
yes.
You know, that
it's amazing.
That there is a market for it. Yeah.
No, and not only that, it's sort of, I think it really does speak to Sundance's essence. And, I mean, when we sent this to them, you know, they immediately were really responsive to it and then eventually said, you know, we want to show as many as 5 hours of it. You know, if we'd had the whole thing done, they might have tried to find a way to get the whole thing in here. That was impossible, but for us. But their commitment to this emerging episodic documentary content is great, and their particular commitment to us was wonderful.
So will it be at a market somewhere?
Oh, it'll be, yeah, it'll play. It's going to get out there. It's not just going to be a festival film or series.
All right. Hey, Steve, thanks for spending some time with us this morning. Steve James, again, the director of America to Me. Again, an indie episodic playing here at the Sundance Film Festival. You're listening to Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from the Crandall family, owners of the New Park Amphitheater, site of the New Park Concert Series, and numerous other community events.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Well, our next interview is focused on the global movement to end child slavery once and for all. Joining me in the studio, I have director Derek Dunning and the subject of his documentary and Nobel Prize winner Kailash Satyarthi. Good morning and thanks for being with us here on the Sundance Reel.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Derek, let me just start with you first. It's your first documentary. Tell us how the story came to be and how you and Kailash kind of hooked up and knew that this was a story that needed to be told.
Yeah, so my producing partner, Davis Guggenheim, was making a film about Malala Yousafzai. He named me Malala, was shooting in Oslo at the time and met Kailash while he was making that movie and emailed me from Oslo. I just met this amazing person. The world needs to hear his story. We should consider telling it. And I was shocked that I hadn't heard the story, that I wasn't aware of the issue hardly at all. And most of my friends and family felt the same way and immediately was inspired and started devouring everything I could about his life and work. And then we went out and met him and spent 3 weeks in India with really no plans other than trying to figure out whether we could make this movie together.
And that's the best part about Sundance, about hearing stories that many of us had never even heard before. So Kailash, what experience was it in your life that you decided to give up your career as an engineer to found what is known as the Save Childhood Movement? And I think there's a Sanskrit term for it, Bakpan?
Yeah, Hindi. That is Hindi. Bachpan Bachao Andolan.
Okay, yeah. So tell us, what was it that happened that you're like, I have a purpose in life?
Well, it was not just one incident, but it was the gradual determination. The first spark was on the first day of my schooling. I was 5 and a half, 6 years old. And when I was entering in school, I saw a cobbler boy sitting along with his father, my age. And I was shocked that why he's sitting out and we are all going to school. Because my imagination was that every child is supposed to go to school. And the boy was looking at me and others whether we are going to give him some job. So I asked my teacher and later on my family members that why a child is not with me in classroom and sitting outside and working. Everybody tried to convince me that they are poor children. They have to work. I was not convinced. And one day I gathered my courage and asked he and his father. And the boy was shy. The father replied that, sir, you don't know that we people are born to work, not born to go to school like you. And that was a bigger shock, but a challenge for me, that why some children are born to go to work and not to school, and at the cost of their childhood and freedom. That was unacceptable for me. I refused to accept that day, and I refuse to accept today.
So how is it that these children come to find themselves in slave labor? It's not that their parents have abandoned them. It's that their parents have taken them there, I mean, and required them to work because they're born into it?
Well, many of them are born in slavery because their parents or grandparents were slaves working for some employer, slave master, landlord. But many of them are pulled into slavery because of the greediness of employers who can earn a lot of money while employing children. And children are most docile. They cannot challenge. They cannot go to the court of law. So normally they are preferred over their own parents. Globally speaking, 152 million children are in full-time child labor today, whereas 210 million adults are jobless. And it's quite shocking to see the parallel that most of these jobless adults are none but the very parents or elder brothers and sisters of these children. So that makes a vicious circle. And I'm challenging that circle as well. We have to create jobs, so we have to abolish child labor completely.
And because those systems are so embedded in local cultures or families, even if you're successful in this film, and I think you referenced Davis with Malala, he ran into this with Malala, does your success in the West create a problem for you as an advocate? Because then you are labeled as, you're just spreading this word in the West. And I think that was some of the criticism Malala ran into in her own country at first. And then she's obviously transcended that. But is that its own challenge, even if you're successful spreading the word, that you now become the voice of the West trying to change these cultures?
I started when I was 24-year-old. So much before even when the Malala was born, I was challenging those systems and those establishments and those mafias. And I had to face all these charges. People ignored me, then they laughed at me, then they opposed me, then they tried to kill me. And finally, a large number of people in my own country and slowly in southern world and in the Western world accepted that slavery has not yet been abolished. And this is a stigma on democracies and societies and civilizations. We have to stop it now. So I have been working across the world, almost in 150 countries for last so many years. So I'd gone through all this.
Good.
Yeah. So in terms of how you made the movie, then you what? You put a camera on Kailash and then... To document some of this?
We spent about, in total, about 6 months of the last 2 years in India shooting with Kailash and his team and his family. So, for me, it really is about spending the time and not just parachuting in for a week or two, but really living with him as he does the work. And, you know, we actually talk a lot about how we could have gone for any, you know, 3-6 month period in his life and found different stories that were, equally dramatic.
Right. So in terms of what we see, though, it sounds like some of the footage is going into these places that employ children and just showing the working conditions.
I think it was important to do that because, you know, again, for me, I didn't have the concept that children are making the clothes that I'm wearing, the goods that I'm buying in the store. And I think we needed to put a face to that. We couldn't just talk about the issue and make it a quote-unquote issue film. We needed to put the audience into his world and get into the factories and see the children working. And then on the flip side, spend time with the children as they go through their recovery and discover their freedom and their childhood for the first time.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember seeing a film last year. I think it was called Machines, and it was showing children in the textile factories. Mm-hmm. and deplorable conditions. I mean, where they were expected to work like 18 hours a day. And
yes.
And I was like, I am never buying another piece of clothing again from Pakistan or India. And I thought, but at the same time, these gives the children a job. I mean, I was really torn about how to live my life so that I'm respecting the children. I don't, is there an answer to that?
Well, I think Kailash's message is clear that children need to be children, that no children should be forced to work. And, of course, their families are often tricked into sending their children to work. They think that they're going to be going and getting a better life. Often they'll be getting an education while they help earn some money for the family. And they don't understand that when they leave, that they are going into these conditions, as you describe, that are deplorable and absolutely horrible. But I think we can all agree that children should have their freedom and should have their childhood and get an education.
Some 80,000 children have been saved by your efforts, huh?
Well, we have freed over 86,000 children by now, but that is the figure. The children were freed through direct action, conducting secret rescue operations and so on with the help of police and judiciary. But when it comes to the indirect actions, pursuing parents, pursuing society, educating society, the number is in millions. When I started globally and fought for an international law to combat the worst forms of child labor like slavery, trafficking, prostitution, the number of child laborers in the world was 260 million. That has fallen down to 152 million. So in last 15 years, we were able to prove that if there is social mobilization, political will, legal actions, consumer actions, we can end child labor. So that's why I'm confident that I'm going to see the end of child slavery in my lifetime.
Keep up the good work. I'm running out of time, but thank you for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to the local, this excuse.